Today is 03-17741, Texas Mutual Insurance and Hofer Builders. Ms. Kenny, did you let them know your time allocations?
Yes, Your Honor. I just need the normal time.
Whenever you're ready.
And I had given to the clerk's office to have distributed to you.
We have them. Thank you.
A hard copy of the electronically filed handout.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. May it please the court. This is a dispute over an endorsement in Texas Mutual's policy that provides reimbursement coverage for Texas employees who are temporarily out of state and choose to collect workers' comp benefits through another state's system. By statute, Texas Mutual cannot provide comp coverage in any state but Texas, but the Department of Insurance does allow Texas Mutual to offer this limited reimbursement for temporary visits out of state. Appley Hofer was Texas Mutual's insured. It hired David Hope, a resident of Florida, to work on a job site in Louisiana. The worker never set foot in Texas, but instead went straight to the job site in Baton Rouge and was injured a few weeks later at that Louisiana job site. Hofer filed a notice of injury with Texas Mutual, which denied the coverage on the ground that Hope was not a Texas employee, and as required by the labor code and agency rules, Texas Mutual filed Hofer's notice of injury and Texas Mutual's denial with the Workers' Compensation Division. No one has ever disputed that denial.
So the facts are undisputed. Is it also undisputed that eventually Mr. Hope was going to come to Texas? Potentially. That was one of the reasons he was hired. And would that fact make a difference?
We don't dispute the affidavit. I think what we have is a vague statement that he might eventually come to work in Texas. I don't think that the record reflects that he was definitely going to come to Texas. That okay. is not what those affidavits said. The affidavits, I think they are in paragraphs 9 and 10 on clerk's record 331 and also clerk's record 145 through 146. And in that, Mr. Hofer says he wasn't that Hope was not specifically hired to work in any particular job. They basically say they have a nationwide business. Mm-hmm. They go all over the country. Mm-hmm. And he was assigned to Louisiana, and then maybe he would go work in Oklahoma, and then maybe eventually a job in Texas.
What if he was, let's say hypothetically, that he was destined, the job required that he was eventually going to come work on a job in Texas? Would that make a difference legally to your argument here today?
He would have had to have been hired or recruited in Texas, so no. Okay. It would not change the
because he
our
was
position.
In, I think, Florida.
He was a Florida resident, right. And he went straight to Louisiana. He was okay. recruited by a telephone call from Hofer's office in Texas,
right.
And then went straight to the job in Louisiana in Baton Rouge and was injured a few weeks later.
And so, Ms. Kenny, just so I'm clear, then your position is that as long as you're recruited, employed in Texas, they can send you to work somewhere else without ever planning on you working in Texas, and the statute wouldn't apply.
I think that might be a literal reading of it. Basically, you have to be hired or recruited in the state, and then you have to be injured within a year of that date of hire.
Right.
So there are limitations in the okay. statute that would keep somebody from just forever working in another state.
Or be here 10 days.
Or be here for 10 days within the 12 months.
Okay.
Yes. So Mr. Hope went ahead and applied for Louisiana benefits after Texas Mutual denied coverage. And under Louisiana law, that requires employers to have comp coverage, so unlike Texas, where it's optional for employers. And so the Louisiana Commission required Hartford, who is the insurer for Hofer's general contractor, to pay the worker his benefits. So the worker got his benefits. But Hofer was continuing to demand reimbursement and coverage from Texas Mutual. So Texas Mutual filed a declaratory judgment action to establish it didn't have any duty to defend Hofer or provide reimbursement for those Louisiana benefits. Hartford intervened because they had paid the claim in Louisiana. Everyone filed summary judgment. The trial court ruled for Hofer and Hartford. The court should reverse for two reasons. First, the district court did not have jurisdiction to find that Mr. Hope was a Texas employee. That issue was within the exclusive jurisdiction of the division. No one challenged Texas Mutual's denial filed with the division, and therefore, Texas Mutual's summary judgment motion should have been granted, because in order to be entitled to reimbursement, you have to establish that the worker was a Texas employee. The labor code gives the division the exclusive power to make the initial determination of whether comp benefits are owed, and as the Supreme Court has holdings in Ruttiger, In re Crawford, and In re Accident Fund establish, the labor code creates the exclusive process and remedies at the division for claims arising out of a carrier's investigation and handling of a comp claim. Labor code 402.00114 requires the division to essentially enforce all of these provisions in the labor code, including these extraterritorial coverage provisions. So determining whether Hope was a Texas employee entitled to benefits is a mandatory first step in determining whether there is any right to reimbursement under the policy.
Is Hope in this proceeding seeking Texas benefits?
No, he is not.
Okay.
He got his benefits. Correct. Pardon?
Does that make a difference?
I don't think it makes a difference under these facts, no.
Because I believe that if this had all happened in Texas, even between, you know, Carrie and all that, that would have had to start it at the DWC. But, I mean, there's no problem that he went to Louisiana, correct, for his Louisiana benefits.
That's the problem.
And this is a reimbursement claim, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
The worker gets to choose. I mean, the employer can't control where the worker files for benefits.
Right.
And Mr. Hope chose to file for benefits in Louisiana.
And so this is not a Texas benefits case.
It's not a Texas benefits case, but it is a Texas Workers' Compensation Act case. So I don't think that makes a difference in terms of the division's jurisdiction. They have argued that the division only has jurisdiction over Texas benefits, but that's not true because, as we said, 402.00114 makes the division essentially the enforcer of the entire Workers' Compensation Act, and that includes the extraterritorial coverage provisions that are at issue here.
What about the National American Insurance Company versus Texas Property and Casualty, which specifically states that, you know, there's no authority for the proposition that the division's exclusive jurisdiction to determine policy benefit claims extend to claims for reimbursement of benefits already paid by a carrier?
Okay. That, in this case, I think that court did hold that a carrier was not required to litigate. It could, but wasn't required to litigate its reimbursement claim at the division under its labor code 409.009. Either Hofer or Hartford could have litigated here as a subclaimant, and that's the subclaimant statute. And what distinguishes that case is that in that case, there had been an entire proceeding at the division over the issue of the employee's status. There was a dispute. Two employers were disagreeing over who was his employer, and that would make a difference as to which carrier would have to pay the claim. And so that was actually tried at the division. It was appealed, and National American won that case. And then they sought to get reimbursement. And what was really at issue in the National American case was the liability of the guarantee fund. The other insurance company became impaired, was taken over, and the question was, does the guarantee fund have to pay reimbursement? So that was really a case where the question turned not so much on the labor code, which the court, I think, held was inapplicable, but on the Guarantee Act. And so I'd also note that National American's appeal in that case was filed and briefed completely before the Supreme Court handed down the decisions in Ruttiger, Crawford, Accident Fund, and City of Houston versus Rule, where in City of Houston versus Rule, the Supreme Court said, if a party is required to litigate an issue at the division and fails to do so, that divests the trial court of jurisdiction over that issue. So I think that the result in National American would have been the same if those cases had been briefed to the court. The case was handed down in 2013, but briefing was completed in 2011, and Ruttiger wasn't handed down until 2012. So the court never addressed that issue and didn't have any reason to. But I think that if a process is available, it should be mandatory under Ruttiger, Crawford, and the other Supreme Court cases. Hofer and Hartford try to circumvent the division's jurisdiction by arguing this is just a contract dispute. But they do it because they conflate two issues. One was whether Hope was a Texas employee, and the other is whether Hofer is entitled to reimbursement for those Louisiana benefits. And those are two separate questions. And you never get to the second one unless you satisfy the first, which is an issue, again, that we submit is committed to the division's exclusive jurisdiction. But I'd like to move in my last 4 minutes that I've got to the merits, because if the court holds that the trial court did have the authority to decide whether Mr. Hope was a Texas employee, it should still reverse. The answer to this question is governed by Labor Code sections 406.071 and 0.072, which are incorporated into the endorsement that's at issue here and control the answer to this question. The handout provides those statutes, and behind it you'll see the excerpt from the endorsement part of the policy, which makes it clear that these are the statutes that are going to govern any right to reimbursement. In order for Hope to have met the extraterritorial coverage requirements in those statutes, he had to meet one of two statutory requirements. The first was he had to have significant contacts with Texas. And then alternatively, he had to have his employment principally located in Texas. Under the statute, significant contacts are defined under subsection B. And it says an employee has significant contacts with this state if the employee was hired or recruited in this state. And then it goes on to impose the additional requirements. You have to be hurt within the year. He was that. But he was neither hired nor recruited in the state of Texas. I think the undisputed facts show that Hope was recruited and hired in Florida. Hofer called Hope at his home in Florida, recruited and hired him there, sent him directly to Baton Rouge, where he filled out his paperwork, and he never stepped foot in Texas. The only connection that Mr. Hope has to Texas is that Hofer has an office in Texas and called Hope to hire him, and then mailed his employment paperwork and his paychecks from that office. If that's enough to constitute recruiting or hiring in Texas, what that means is that a Texas-based company could use a single Texas-only policy to cover its employees worldwide simply by hiring its employees with a phone call from Texas. That would render the significant contacts requirement of the Labor Code meaningless. Now, Hofer.
But do you think that maybe the labor code could have, or the legislature could have inserted the word resident to make it more clear? And that by not including the term resident, possibly.
I guess
what I'm getting at is, I mean, are you saying that the statute is ambiguous or no?
No. Okay. I think it's absolutely clear.
Okay.
You have to be hired or recruited in this state. You don't have to be a Texas resident.
So you have to come here, then they look at you and they go, yeah, you're cool, go back to Florida and then go to Louisiana.
If he had done that, he probably would have qualified under the statute. If he had actually come and been interviewed and been hired in Saginaw, Texas at Hofer Builder's office and then had an injury within a year, he would fall within the statute. He did not do that. Hofer and Hartford try to support their claim that this is a Texas employee by relying on his previous employment. That was relied on heavily in the trial court. But that employment ended in 2007 More than 7 years before Hofer hired Hope for this job in 2014. So they can't rely on the past employment from 7 years before, because that scenario fails to meet the requirement that the injury occur not later than 1 year after the date of hire. So if he was hired in 2007, he falls out of the coverage of the
So this is only
statute.
B1 then?
Pardon?
This is only B1.
Correct.
071B1.
That is what he would fall under if...
If at all.
If at all.
No, now, not B. We're looking at A, correct? No. B1 is...
Well, one, not two, is my point.
Correct, A1.
Right.
Sorry.
Can I ask you a question? And then this is probably just from my trial days in how we view summary judgments. How is, and both sides obviously thought that it's a matter of law because both of them filed summary judgments, but how is it that whether an employee is hired or recruited in Texas is not a fact question?
I think under the undisputed facts here, he's not. We have evidence. It's not disputed that the phone call was placed from Texas. That's not.
I understand that the facts are not disputed. Okay. But you're saying, I guess everybody agrees, and obviously we'll ask the other side the same thing, that this is not something that there has to be a full developed record or anything, that you can, on summary judgment, assume these facts.
Well, there is a fairly fully developed record, Your Honor. There are answers to interrogatories in the summary judgment evidence. There are answers to requests for admissions in the summary judgment evidence. There are two affidavits from Mr. Hofer, both the affidavit that they filed in support of their motion and the affidavit that we filed that he had filed in Louisiana. And so it's not that the record's not developed. There was.
Correct. I think all the facts are there.
Right.
But both sides agree, your position is both sides agree that this can be decided under summary judgment, not under anything else.
Well, what they have said in their reply is that they can keep their summary judgment, but we can't have ours. I'm not quite sure how that fits logically, but I do think under the undisputed facts, it's a question of law. And I see that my time is up. I'll try to cover some of the rest of this, I guess, on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Steve Knight on behalf of Hartford Underwriters Insurance Company. As we've heard, there's two primary issues in this appeal. First, did the trial court properly determine that it has jurisdiction over HBI, I call Hofer HBI, and Hartford's contractual claim for reimbursement against TMI with respect to the workers' compensation benefits that were paid to Mr. Hope under Louisiana law? And number two, did the trial court properly determine that TMI is in fact liable under the contract with respect to that claim? I'm going to start with the jurisdiction issue, but before I actually get to that, I want to clarify one thing that I think is important, and you're going to see how it's going to tie into my argument with respect to the contacts issue in a few minutes. The question was asked of opposing counsel, wasn't this guy, Mr. Hope, hired to perform work in Texas? Because that's an important point. And the answer that was given suggested we don't really know, or not so much, because his first job was in Louisiana. I want the court to be aware that the summary judgment record is very clear. The reason Mr. Hope's prior employment ever came up was to demonstrate that this Texas-based company, it only has an office in Texas, and it handles projects primarily in Texas, but sometimes it gets projects out of Texas. Mr. Hope worked for decades at this company working primarily Texas jobs. The reason that's important is because the testimony and the summary judgment record, what it shows is that he was rehired to fulfill that very same role. So in Mr. Hofer's affidavit, he explains at CR 144 that he had handled hundreds of jobs in the state of Texas as the superintendent for this Texas-based construction company. And he further testified that when he was hired specifically to go work at that Louisiana job, and then one of the next jobs in line was a Texas job. That was the job offer that was given to him. That's the job offer that he accepted. He was hired to work in Texas.
Well, you know, to segue right back to Justice Triana's question, let's assume that that fact is agreed to by all, and I think that that's how it was presented to the trial court. These are the underlying facts that we all agreed to. Isn't the question of whether or not, or do you agree, is the question of whether or not Mr. Hope is a Texas, was hired or recruited in Texas. Isn't that a question of fact? Is that proper summary judgment?
I think that the summary judgment record demonstrates under the standards for what hired or recruited in Texas means, and I'm going to get to that. I think the summary judgment record conclusively resolves that issue in our favor. To the extent it doesn't, I suppose the answer is it could be a fact issue, and that's what the Texas Supreme Court held in the case that followed the Gallagher case, which is the Dossie case. They actually said, well, the parties disagree on whether a Texas job was contemplated as part of his employment, so we're going to remand it on that issue.
And that's what you say makes this case distinguishable from that holding.
What I'm saying is there is no dispute. Right. It's the affidavit that I cited a moment ago, but it's also in the deposition testimony at CR 172. So whereas in the case that I mentioned a moment ago, it was ambiguous or unclear as to whether a Texas job was contemplated as part of the employment. We've established that in the summary judgment record. They've not offered any facts to dispute that.
But I have two questions. One is, assuming that, yes, he was going to come to work here. One, where in the statute, and this goes back to what I asked Ms. Kinney, where in the statute does it say you have to work in Texas, at least during the first 12 months, after you get hired? So why is that important, that he was going to come to work to Texas? And two, as to the summary judgment, whether, it's a factual or not, how can you argue, if everybody agrees that all of the relevant facts, everything has been developed and is in the record, then why would we have to remand it, sort of like, how can you say, well, if you agree with my position, yes, as a matter of law, go ahead and find for me. But if you don't agree with my position, then you have to remand it back to the trial court to find out whether he was hired or employed or recruited here in Texas.
So as to the first part of your question, there's some cases out there where somebody may be maybe physically in Texas, but is hired to perform work solely and exclusively in other states. And some bodies, whether the workers' comp or courts, have said, we're not going to say that that person is a Texas employee. It's too far removed. So that's the answer to the first question. Our case is different because he was hired to work in Texas. With respect to the second question.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I'm looking at 406071. An employee who's injured while working in another jurisdiction or the employee's legal beneficiary is entitled to all rights and remedies under this subtitle if the injury would be compensable, we're not arguing about, the employee has significant contacts with this state, or the employment is principally located in this state. So I understand that or the employment is in the state, but employee has significant contacts, you go to the, B, and that's, he was hired or recruited in this state. So theoretically, you can have a non-Texas resident come here, hired here, apply for a job, never live here, live in Florida, never contemplate that he's going to work here. Why would this statute not still cover?
The statute might cover it, but that broadens the reading of the statute, which only benefits our position here. Here, this guy lived in Florida. He went to work at the first job in Louisiana, and he undisputably was then coming to Texas to perform more work. So under any test, he qualifies as having these contacts.
But I'm asking, why do you believe it's so important that he is going to come to work? Whether statute or case, where does it say, and if we are to believe the record that he was going to come to Texas, then it's a hands down, he fits under this statute.
The only reason that I would underscore the fact that it's important that he was coming to Texas is based on, they've cited a slew of these appeal number matters. And in some of these, that they've cited in their brief, the Workers' Comp Commission has said, look, because the this is a situation where somebody might be in Texas and somebody sends an agent in to go, you know, get this guy to come to work exclusively, come and move to Pennsylvania, live in Pennsylvania, work solely and exclusively in Pennsylvania. There's been cases like that under that fact pattern where the Workers' Comp Division has said, look, that's too far removed. We're not going to call him a Texas employee. And it may be the reason that they've held that is because it didn't arise under a claim for reimbursement. It arose in a different context altogether.
Okay.
So let me turn to the jurisdiction issue quickly, because TMI argues that HBI and Hartford were required to come and contest TMI's determination that no Texas benefit should be paid, that they were required to contest that decision before the TWC, the DWC, and actually submit a claim as a subclaimant, somehow as a condition of ever seeking reimbursement.
If this happened in Texas, they would, wouldn't they?
If
they were seeking reimbursement, wouldn't they?
That's the case that was asked about, okay. Where there was the concurrent jurisdiction. If this case involved Texas benefits, there would at least be an argument, although the case that was mentioned, even the argument would even fail under that. But what's significant here is there's absolutely no requirement for Hartford, for HBI, or for Mr. Hope to have challenged that initial determination, as opposed to Mr. Hope simply making the decision, well, the workers' comp carrier in Texas isn't going to cover me, I'm going to go to Louisiana. And the moment he and by the way, under Labor Code 406.075, that option is given to him. 406.075 says, an injured employee who elects to pursue the employee's remedy under the workers' compensation laws of another jurisdiction and who recovers benefits under those laws may not recover under the statute. The reason that is significant is because the moment Mr. Hope decided to go pursue his benefits in Louisiana, DWC lost any conceivable interest in anything having to do with his claim. He's not eligible for Texas workers' comp benefits. This case has nothing to do with those benefits. DWC has no jurisdiction to make any ruling, which would be a purely advisory opinion in a subsequent contract claim for reimbursement of those benefits.
Hence your assertion that this is simply a claim under the reimbursement endorsement.
That's it. It's a contract claim, and significantly, in their contract that they wrote, TMI said, Travis County, Texas, the courts here, Travis County is the sole venue for any lawsuit involving reimbursement under this endorsement. Any lawsuit involving reimbursement. This lawsuit involves reimbursement. That's what it's all about.
So then what about the applicability of Ruttier and those holdings?
So the applicability of every single case that they've cited in their brief, each and every case is so easily distinguishable because they involved claims for Texas workers' compensation benefits. They're not contract claims for reimbursement. So it's not surprising that when a claimant who was denied coverage then sues in district court for bad faith denial of Texas benefits, that the court say, look, you've got an administrative procedure here. You got to go to the DWC and exhaust the remedies. That's not at all surprising.
But then we look back to the actual reimbursement endorsement, and it says for those Texas employees who are described in the Texas Labor Code.
The mere fact that they took language from the Texas statute and put it in their contract as the test for contractual reimbursement doesn't make it a Texas workers' compensation claim. It just doesn't. Private parties can contract and implement standards from statutes all the time. That doesn't make it a statutory cause of action. It's still a claim under the contract. And I want to highlight, well, I've already mentioned that every case that they've cited for the idea that you have to go before the DWC involved Texas benefits, easily distinguishable. Every case that I've cited, notably the Sonic case and the companion appeal number case before the DWC, addresses this issue point blank. When somebody pays workers' comp benefits in another state, seeks reimbursement here, the DWC has no jurisdiction because it's not a claim for Texas workers' compensation benefits anymore. The DWC said in Appeal 020771, quote, The general question of reimbursement of Alabama benefits is not and cannot be decided by the commission's hearing officer. You just can't get any plainer than that. So, you know, I submit that the court properly decided that it has jurisdiction. It clearly has jurisdiction. And now I'd like to get to the actual merits here. Their contract, the contractual reimbursement scheme, says that the coverage is for injuries to your Texas employees that occur in another state if, and one is there's the timing component, that's not an issue here. What we're really focused on is the second part of this in their contract that says if the employee has significant contacts with Texas or the employment is principally located in Texas. So either contacts or principal location. We submit that both, we only have to meet one, but here both of these tests are met. And I'm going to start with the principal location issue. The 406.072, which was again adopted within their contractual reimbursement scheme, is the test for principal location. Principal location is has to be one of these. It's either one, where the employer has a place of business at or from which the employee regularly works, or it is two, where the employee resides and spends a substantial part of the employee's working time.
But did y'all make this argument in trial court?
So they've argued, made a waiver point. Yes, we've raised this issue in the summary judgment motion.
Where?
I'll point you to clerk's record at 66, which is page 7 of the summary judgment motion, where we stated as a ground for summary judgment that we meet both conditions of 406.071 and 072. They've raised it in their summary judgment motion at clerk's record 246 at 13, where they quote the entirety of the statute. And then finally, at clerk's record 897 is the court's ruling that says we are entitled to judgment on the statute as a whole, not a subpart of it. So I submit that the issue is properly raised and their waiver point goes nowhere. Now, as I mentioned, it has to be one of those two things, principal location or contacts. Okay, so I'll start with number two. It has to be either where the employee has the place of business at or from which he regularly works or where he resides and spends a significant part of his time. I want to start with the second one because where he resides was Florida. Where he was going to spend significant time was Texas. So number two doesn't really answer the question of where's the principal location, because it gives us two possibilities. It's not a clear answer. So I submit that means under the statute, the first part of it has to answer the question. There has to be a principal location. So we're under one, where the employer has a place of business at or from which the employee regularly works, at or from which. They say he wasn't in Texas. He wasn't in the office in Texas, and therefore he can't win under this provision. Well, that only addresses at. Where did he work from? This company only has one headquarters, one business office. It's in Texas. Everything is done in Texas. Paychecks, jobs, job assignments, decisions, reimbursements. Everything is done in Texas. He works from Texas. There's no other option. This is the only place of business. So under this part of the reimbursement scheme, we win as a matter of law because he qualifies as a Texas employee based on principal place of business. We also win under the significant contacts analysis. And I think a question was raised, which is something that's gone through my mind repeatedly as I wrote the brief. Under their argument, you're telling me that the dialogue that HBI had with Mr. Hope about, do you want the job that you had before for decades working in Texas, Texas jobs and some jobs at other states? You know, let's talk about hiring you. Let's talk about money. Let's talk about logistics. Let's talk about all the things that are substantive to becoming an employee of this Texas company. The question was asked, so you mean he'd be a Texas employee if he made the flight over to Texas and had that same dialogue, but he's not just because they chose to use the modern convenience of a telephone? It's just not a realistic outcome. And not surprisingly, the standards that govern the court's analysis under the significant contacts leads to that very conclusion. The standards that have been developed over the years that this court has to apply is, number one, There is no residency requirement. The fact that he's in Florida doesn't matter. He can be a Texas employee. And most notably, the best example of that is the Collins case that we cited at 321 Southwest 2nd 178. That was a Oklahoma resident. That was a salesman. He got all of his instructions on where to go, what to do, how to do it, where to get paid, how to get paid, et cetera, from a Houston office. Very similar here. So no residency requirement. Number two, the word in, hired or recruited in Texas, doesn't mean that he has to be physically present here. They cite the Gallagher case for several propositions. Let me read something from Gallagher. The phrase, who has been hired in this state, has no reference to the place where the contract of hiring took place. In doesn't mean you have to be physically in Texas. That's their own case. What is key is, and this goes back to the earlier questions, according to appeal number 92634, for purposes of deciding, is he a Texas employee? What's important is Texas work being contemplated? Even if it hasn't been performed yet, is it at least being contemplated? In that appeal, the quote is, coverage of a Texas employee for an out-of-state injury required hiring and some work or intention of work in Texas. There's no question there's an intention of work in Texas in this case.
What number is that again, please?
Appeal number 92634. It's 1993 Westlaw 47919, a 1993 opinion. The fourth principle that guides this court's analysis, coverage applies even if he works and is injured out of state first. And that's the Dossie case that overruled Gallagher's proposition to the contrary. And then the other thing is, going way back to a 1934 case, the Texas Employer Association versus Volek, where they made a comment that I underline because I think it is important. It says, when we're looking at this, we ought to look at the entire record of his employment. The entire record of his employment plays in. Why is that important here? Because he worked for decades in Texas, doing Texas work, taking instructions from a Texas office. And the sites that I gave you from the deposition and the affidavit, he's being rehired for that same work, and it's Texas-based. So, you know, here, under those standards that I've just articulated, that is supported by the case law that I've cited, there's no question that Mr. Hope had significant contacts with Texas. He worked here for decades. He was rehired to do that same work. Most of his projects are in Texas. He will occasionally handle projects in other states. And he takes all of his assignments from the only Hofer office that exists, and it's in the state of Texas, where his employer is located. He's a Texas employee. I would like to actually, I see my time is up. Does the court have any questions for me? So just in conclusion, we'd ask the court to affirm the summary judgment in our favor. The trial court did not err, and we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Thank you.
Ms. Kinney.
On the principal location argument, they clearly did not raise that in the trial court. You can look at the record sites that they have. They cite to Clerk's Record 66. The site is to Section 406.071 of the Labor Code. Counsel said it was to both statutes. It's not there, and maybe my word search version doesn't work, but I searched that entire clerk's record, and I could not find where they made that argument. But it also, they failed to prevail on that basis. They concede that they are not, that the employee didn't reside or spend a substantial amount of time in Texas. But they argue that he worked at or from the Texas office. He never was in Texas. The appeals panel decisions, there is no Texas court decision, there is no appeals panel decision out of the division that would have recognized that working in another state means you're working at or from an office in Saginaw, Texas. And in fact, the only thing that I could find in searching through Westlaw was a dicta in one of the Sonic decisions. in which the Court of Appeals said it apparently, you know, working at a nuclear plant in Alabama is not working at or from a Texas location. So they cannot win on that. They didn't raise it. They've done a good job of trying to articulate an argument here, but the reason they didn't raise it in the trial court is because it doesn't work, and it still doesn't work. The Sonic case helps us. The Sonic is a 2002 decision in which the employer sought reimbursement, and the hearing officer decided all the issues, found that it was a Texas employee who would have been entitled to Texas benefits, but because he elected to take benefits under the Alabama system, he was precluded. So they addressed all of those. And then the hearing officer went ahead and decided the reimbursement question. Well, the reimbursement question, we think, was already decided, but clearly the commission, it was the commission at the time, it's now the division, they took jurisdiction over the case and over the question of, is this worker a Texas employee? They resolved that question, and that is our argument. They have conflated two issues. We think that even today, the Sonic decision where the division said, well, we can't decide the reimbursement question, I think under this court's decisions, including the National American, which said, well, you can, that they could have done that. And they might reach a different result. You'll see there's a discussion in one of your other cases where the court recognizes that this 409.009 is a broad statute, and it does give subclaimants substantial rights to seek relief. So, you know, the Sonic decision actually supports our position on the division having the exclusive jurisdiction over the first question, which is this a Texas employee? Their argument that Ruediger and all of those only deal with claims handling, and they have argued, Texas, we're not challenging Texas Mutual's claims handling activity. That's exactly what Texas Mutual did. They got a notice of injury, which is a form you get that's a Department of Insurance form, and they denied the claim, and they denied coverage, and they filed all of that with the division so that it would all be there in the event Hofer or Hartford desired to pursue a claim, or if Hope had decided to. Also, the notion that this is simply an endorsement that Texas Mutual came up with. Texas Mutual can't put anything in its policy that's not approved by the Texas Department of Insurance. So this is not something that's simply negotiated. It is a provision that is a labor code provision, and it has to be approved by the Department of Insurance. The statement about working in the future in Texas, I think you need to look at what those affidavits actually say. This is what he said. This is what Mr. Hofer says in paragraph 9. It's on Clerk's Record 145. As before, David Hope would be working for HBI on its projects across the United States, including those projects in Texas, as the circumstances of the company required. At the time David Hope was hired in 2014, HBI had made arrangements to work on three upcoming projects: the Penrow Apartments in Texas, the Millennium Project in Oklahoma, and the Burbank Drive Apartments projects in Louisiana. And as another affidavit will establish, first place was to go to Louisiana. Then, if as the circumstances required, he would go to Oklahoma, and he might eventually make his way to Texas. But that is still not hiring or recruiting in Texas. And I think that was one of the earlier questions. Even if he might eventually come to Texas, he had to have been hired or recruited here. In Gallagher, when they said the location of the hiring is not controlling, that was under the older provision. And the courts have used that to essentially preclude extraterritorial coverage. I have never seen a case where they have used that concept to allow a phone call from Texas to a Florida resident or a resident of another state, and to have that constitute recruiting or hiring in Texas.
There's no case on that whatsoever.
I cannot find one.
Okay.
And the appeals, the division has rejected that, the notion that a phone call can constitute hiring, but the employee needs to be in Texas. They've allowed that, but they've never allowed a phone call from Texas. And again, the problem that we will have is you have a company that they say they have a nationwide business. They need a multi-state policy. Texas Mutual can't be insuring companies that are going to work worldwide and then simply try to recover under a Texas-only policy. I see I'm way past my time. The court doesn't have any questions?
No. Thank you. You're excused, and the case will be submitted. At this point, we are going to